It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at the controversy surrounding a potential visit to Taiwan by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Now, we often celebrate creativity, but what if you're just not the creative type? Well, it's true that a lot of us may never paint a timeless painting or compose a symphony, but our next guest says you may not be giving yourself enough credit for the less obvious ways that your creativity comes out. And he says creative people aren't just born that way. You can learn to be more creative, too. We're listening back to that conversation now, and we want to hear from you. What does creativity look like in your life? Has the pandemic led you to be more creative in your parenting, staying connected to loved ones, or how you have fun? Have you tried new ways to be creative? How often do you go outside of your comfort zone? Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org, or tweet us at centraltimewpr. Matt Richtel is a science reporter for the New York Times. His latest book is called Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. He joined the show earlier this year. You've followed this subject for a long time. I've talked to you a little bit about creativity in the past. What is so interesting to you about figuring out our creativity?
Well, I'll give you a quick answer, and then I want to ask you a question and maybe ask listeners to do the same thing. Oh, yeah.
I ask the questions here.
How come I can't be the host? That seems more creative. Do you ever have that feeling where you get an idea and then you are inspired? You think it might be the best idea you've ever heard. You're in a vacuum of inspiration and you're just going to go for it. Does that resonate?
Not the best idea, but yeah, sometimes I think I got a pretty good idea.
You got a pretty good idea. Well, for whatever reason, sometime in after my 20s, I started getting hit with all these ideas. I created a syndicated comic strip and wrote 10 books and wrote a bunch of songs and whatever's happened at the New York Times. And I started to get interested in what that feeling was that drives so many people. And so I looked to science and I looked to great creators in the book. I talked to Yo-Yo Ma, Judd Apatow, Steve Kerr of the Warriors, you know, go down the list of all these great creators to figure out, is there something biological and fundamental about creativity? And what the heck is it?
I want to spoil the answer here, but yes, it sounds like if I read you right, there is something in our, like as humans, in our DNA that makes creativity happen. Like you talk to scientists, why would we evolve to have this creativity?
Yeah. And I even went all the way into the lab looking at bacteria and how they respond when bombarded by a threat and how they create their way out of the situation. And without giving so much of it away, discovered ultimately that there is a deep biological underpinning to our creative urges and then traced that forward to how that plays out in our own lives.
All right. So we got little kids. They're creative as heck. We all are. But you write about something you call the fourth grade slump. What happens to us in fourth grade?
Yeah, I went and looked at this research that started about in the 1950s, where researchers were trying to figure out what makes us creative and what hampers our creativity. And it was a period of time, Rob, where we were beginning to ask as a society, what is this thing called creativity? We value it a lot. Why does it seem so elusive? And here's why. When you're a little kid, ideas flow through you without judgment. Somewhere around fourth grade, the research shows, creative explosions start to actually diminish. Now, why would that be? Well, it's right around this time that young people begin to internalize rules before they internalize impulses. So, Rob, when you're raising kids as I'm doing, and I don't know what your situation is, I promise not to ask any deeply personal questions.
I got a pair of them, first year of college.
You
now.
Got a pair. Okay, so do these sentences resonate? Don't run into the street. Don't pick your nose and eat it.
Careful
don't
on
eat
the
that
steps.
Off the floor. Tons of no's. And what it does is it conditions people to begin to say no before they begin to say yes. What is the rule that would impair me or interfere with me before I go forward? Here's the problem. Creativity at its core is an act of permission. It begins with allowing your mind to flow with ideas oftentimes ideas that are against the status quo, against the rule system, run afoul of something you've heard. So you are conditioned from a very young age to begin to shut those down.
How do we break out of those rules?
Yeah, to be plain, this is not precisely a health self-help book. This is more of a scientific journey, but I can't deny that in the end, the questions you ask are the very ones I sought to answer myself. And there are a bunch of tools we can use. I'll give you a couple of examples without going over all the studies in the book. One of them has to do with mind wandering. And believe it or not, this is something we often do and really dislike. So when people's mind wanders, actually, can I pause, Rob, and give you an exercise to explain what I mean by mind wandering?
Yeah,
absolutely. It will involve another deeply personal question.
Good, good.
Okay, here we go. Before you go to bed at night, don't kick me off the air.
I'm with you so far.
I'll say that I have these fantasies. I'm not talking about, you know, those kind of fantasies. I'm talking about various ideas that pop in my head and flow through my mind. I had a friend, for example, explain she likes to imagine herself flying. When I was a kid, I used to imagine myself in a sporting goods store where I could buy anything I wanted. Our family didn't have much money. Do you have anything like that you used to think about or think about before bed?
Oh, yeah, sure. But like, it's better if I just drift into it, though, than consciously think about it. I mean, there's different things. I like board games. I think about those a lot. I'll say
all kinds of things. Okay. Now, you may not think about that as mind wandering. You may not have think of that in any way as a creative impulse. But when those ideas flow through your mind without filter, that's a little bit what mind wandering feels like. Here's the thing that the research shows. It shows, one, that when your mind wanders, you often come up with ideas that may elude you otherwise. And in fact, I can cite in a second, if you want, how some great creators use that. But just for a second, take it on face. The problem, though, is that when people's mind wanders, they often stop it when they're in the middle of their day, because mind wandering sometimes goes to worry. And people feel they're being unproductive. So to cultivate that idea of permission means cultivating this idea of mind wandering and giving it a little bit more breath than we often do.
We're talking to Matt Richtel about his new book, Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. Let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234. Jordan is with us in Antigo. Jordan, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on this afternoon.
What did you want to tell us about?
I attended a seminar working with youth programming and youth groups, and the presenter was talking about creativity in that mindset. And the point that he brought up was very interesting, is that creativity is not something you have to dredge up out of yourself. If you think of creativity as being an expectation plus a modification. And the example that he used was soccer. Two teams, one ball, two goals. That's the expectation. But now what happens when you add a second ball, or you add two more teams and two more goals, or two more goals but keep the same number of teams? And all of a sudden you have this tree of possibilities that to the outsider looks spontaneous and creative, but really it's just the two simple phases of an expectation and a modification.
Jordan, thanks for that call. Matt, that reminds me, in your book, you talked to a group of young folks and gave them take a normal thing and what if. What was their answer? Something like, what if you flush the toilet and it traveled you into space, or something to that effect?
Yeah.
Is there something what our caller is saying there?
Well, there's a few things I love about Jordan's call, but I want to tell him a visceral reaction I had and explain what the science is behind it. So when he said two balls, I was like, well, no, you can't do two balls in soccer. And here's some great science. It turns out, and this was a piece that appeared in the New York Times today that excerpted from the book about why we often resist creative ideas. So explicitly, we often say, I want to be creative. I want to hire someone who's creative. But there is an implicit note. But studies will show that when they look at our subconscious feelings about creativity, they're very different than the feelings we say we have. And in fact, we subconsciously associate creativity with toxins and vomit and poison. Well, why would that be? To trace it back to Jordan's question, when we challenge the status quo, it means that we're going to have to change the way we conceptualize something. We may have to change our activities, our actions. We may have to change our whole lifestyle. And in fact, Rob, creativity often is very disruptive. So it's worth noting that we have these reactions internally that sometimes get in the way of our creativity because secretly we harbor visceral concerns about it.
We're listening back to a conversation we had with Matt Richtel, author of the book Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. We want to hear about your creativity story. When do you feel the most creative? Is it in your job, a hobby, some other part of life, maybe your relationships? Did you find more time during the pandemic to try something new? Do you feel more creative now than in the past? Let us know. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. Or tweet us @centraltimewpr. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. That's the song From Darkness, written and sung by our guest, Matt Richtel. We're talking to him about his new book, Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an example of how you use creativity in your life? Do you feel like you got to have some kind of creative outlet? Do you feel like you've lost it at some point? And have you ever solved a problem when you stopped thinking about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, there you are, Matt, writing a song and singing the song. You write fiction. You mentioned a comic strip. You're a science writer. That's your day job. And a lot of us might think, okay, I'm going to stay in my lane and not try all this stuff. Why encourage us to do some of the things you've done and branch out like that?
Oh, get out of your lane, baby. And if anybody wants to hear that full song, my email is mattrichtel@gmail.com, and I will send it to you. And I am, do I want to say I'm proud of it or I believe in it? Listen, believe in yourself. But let's guide me a little bit, Rob. Where do you want me to take this?
Like, so how can we, like songwriting, I'm a musician, right? And I feel pretty good about my musical output. I am a god-awful songwriter. I have no... I tried once. The world didn't need to hear it. How could you tell somebody in that situation, yeah, Rob, go back and try writing another song? Everybody's got probably something similar to that, that they're just... they'd be too embarrassed to share it with the world.
This is my... well, let me start with some science and come back to that answer.
Yeah.
One of the... because you alluded to this before. Another interesting study. This one looked at... artists, musicians, and physicists, and asked them to write down what they were doing when they solved a problem that they were trying, a creative problem they were trying to solve. And 20% of the time, they solved it when they weren't actively thinking about it. Now, that number may not seem so high, but the researcher said to me, how many things can you point to that you actually do at your very best when you're not trying? This is an idea that came to me from a variety of creators I talked to. Gary Trudeau, who created Doonesbury, gets his ideas in the shower. And Jane Pauley, his wife, keeps a pad of paper by her bed and scribbles down the ideas when she wakes up. Salvador Dali and Einstein used to take a nap with a rock or heavy object in their hands. And when they woke up, they would have an idea at the tip of their minds. The researcher calls it a hypnagogic state between wakefulness and sleep. To answer your question, Rob, if you sat down to say, I'm going to write a song right now, I think that's putting yourself in a very difficult position. If you were to carry with yourself the idea that I'm playing with music right now and I am open to song ideas coming to me, eventually I feel very certain they would emerge. And here's why. Over time, Rob, you have internalized the shape of a song. That is not elusive to you. Verse, chorus, or verse, verse, chorus, verse, chorus. Moreover, you know how long it is, 3.5 minutes. And you know that you're probably going to use 1, 4, and 5. Sorry, those are chord progressions for those of you listening. So a lot of this has been solved. I say put it in the back of your mind and see what happens.
Excellent. Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Joy is with us in Monona. Joy, hi.
How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Joy?
Good. I have a question that I'm going to try to make succinct. It's kind of a large area, but I'm wondering if Matt, your guest, has looked into or studied morphic resonance. It's a concept brought up by Rupert Sheldrake, an English thinker in, I think, the 60s. And anyway, it's about the concept that there's a kind of a universal unconsciousness or unconscious in the world, and that is where ideas come from. It's called morphic resonance, and it's really fascinating. And two quick examples to give you an idea of how this works is that there's records of researchers working with different kinds of monkeys around the world, and they were trying to get, one study was trying to get a matriarch to take her bananas down to the water and wash them, and then, you know, hopefully her whole clan would follow suit. Well, she wouldn't do it. She refused. But then around the world, they started getting calls from researchers saying, what's going on? Our monkey, like our matriarch, our alpha male, female is taking her bananas down to water and washing them before she eats them. And now the whole group is doing that.
Joy, thanks for the example. We don't have a ton of time, but Matt, I'm not familiar with that idea, but the general idea that there is this pool of ideas out there that any of us might tap into at a given moment.
Yeah. I mean, I actually think Joy brings up a really interesting point without having studied that particular language, and I'll tie it to some science I can validate for you. There have been periods of time in human history where specific areas of the world have been really rich with creativity. Jerusalem at the year zero, Harlem, Russia, Florence, France, Silicon Valley, Hollywood. What the research will bear out is that when you have certain connections among people that are dense, you wind up getting cooperation, collaboration, competition, and ideas are in the air that really intensify the creative process. Now, that may not sound like the same thing as what Joy's describing, but in a way, it's a more physical description of how the subconscious becomes flowing through a population. I would just add, Rob, that you can make a pretty good case that we are at the most creative period in human history. And one of the reasons for that is that technology is allowing those ideas to be shared across borders, among people, across interest groups and niches. Just listen to this simple statistic. In 2018, there were 144,000 patents applied for by international collaborators. That's a little less than double from the number in 2000. So we're seeing an explosion of that kind of cooperation across the globe.
We are talking to Matt Richtel about his new book out today called Inspired: Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. Matt, earlier you mentioned that deep down, a lot of us are actually kind of scared of creativity, of novelty, of having to change the way we do things. So if someone is in charge of something, a teacher, a business manager, whatever, and they think they want creativity, how do they actually create a setting where people do get to be creative and run with it?
I just want to say that is a hugely great question that vexes scholars. And they will say that the middle managers are in one of the toughest positions and managers in all of the world. In fact, some of the research will show that when people are most in need of solutions, they're least able to accept them because the status quo feels safe at a time of great uncertainty. And so I think what it requires in the first instance is an acknowledgement that there must be a safe space for the expression of those ideas wherein the manager or leader agrees not to feel threatened by what happens. And some of those ideas will be terrible. In fact, one of the lessons of the biology of creativity and of creativity itself is that the most creative people, Einstein and Mozart and lots of others, were much better at quantity than they were at quality. There's a terrific story about Einstein that I heard where he says to a colleague, I've got it. I've got the unified field theory. And the colleague says, Albert, that's terrific, except under that theory, the universe can't exist. And people who create a lot come up with a lot of ideas, and some of them are terrible, and others are too scary, and some of them are just right, if you like your Three Bears analogy. And so that's what I would encourage leaders to create a safe space and recognize that quantity is where quality comes from.
It's a great place to leave it. Matt, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was New York Times science journalist Matt Richtel. We listened back to our conversation from earlier this year about his book, Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. When Rebecca Clayfish entered the race for governor, she was the presumed Republican frontrunner. But now the former lieutenant governor may be at risk of losing her primary campaign. As she closes out the race, she's reminding voters of the work she did with former Governor Scott Walker more than a decade ago. As Sean Johnson reports, the question now is whether that will work.
There have been big events during Rebecca Clayfish's 2022 run for governor that have not broken her way. But in the closing weeks of her primary campaign, there are little moments that have Clayfish feeling like it's 2010 all over again. During an interview at a recent GOP picnic in Verona, Clayfish gets interrupted from across the park, but in a good way.
You know, we put...
Thank you. Love you guys. Tell your friends August 9th, please.
Clayfish says moments like these remind her of her first run for office in 2010.
And there was a moment at which you could feel almost palpable momentum on the ground, and it's stuff like that.
2010 was the year Clayfish jumped headfirst into politics. She won a crowded GOP primary for lieutenant governor and joined Scott Walker's ticket. She was there in 2011 when Walker introduced Act 10, his landmark bill that all but eliminated public sector union rights. And they both survived historic recall elections in 2012.
Now this is what democracy looks like!
After Walker narrowly lost to Democratic Governor Tony Evers in 2018 and later announced he would not run in 2022, Clayfish became the presumed frontrunner. She's since been endorsed by a long list of Republican power brokers, including Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, the business giant Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and most prominently, Walker.
Hi, I'm Scott Walker. Please join me in voting for Rebecca Clayfish for governor. Rebecca stood with me as we took on the big government special interest and cut taxes.
With each endorsement has come an overt reminder that Clayfish was there a decade ago, when Republicans won control of state government and fundamentally changed Wisconsin. Longtime GOP operative Brian Schimming says it's an effective way for Clayfish to remind voters of her record.
You know, there's a reason she's got him out front as much as she does, and that is he still is power, very powerful motivator with Republican primary voters and the grassroots, 100% name ID.
But Schimming says there are reasons Walker's support and Clayfish's record weren't enough to clear the field. Being lieutenant governor isn't quite the same as being governor, he says. There's also the old adage.
You know, for some folks, it's the oldest thing in the book. That was then and this is now. And
the Republican Party of 2022 is different from the party of 2010. Walker and Clayfish won with a base of support in the suburbs. Republicans still turn out the vote there, but not by quite as much. Meanwhile, at least some GOP voters actively dislike all of Clayfish's establishment ties. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha.
Those who were standard bearers before are not necessarily in the positions that they had been in terms of what their endorsements mean, you know, what kind of popularity they have.
Clayfish also missed out on the biggest endorsement when former President Donald Trump backed her opponent, construction executive Tim Michaels. Michaels, who only entered the race in April, has since spent millions of his own money on ads and shot up in the polls. But when asked why she wasn't able to put this race away earlier, Clayfish rejects the premise of the question.
Nobody's entitled to anything. Things must be earned, and there's no one who can outwork me.
That was who she was in 2010, Clayfish says. That's who she is now. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR is running a series of profiles ahead of Wisconsin's August 9th primary election. We'll continue to profile Republicans running for governor over the course of this week. Now, U.S. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has planned a trip to Taiwan next month, creating political controversy in China and in the U.S. The Chinese government has threatened consequences if Pelosi visits the island. Taiwan is self-governing, but China claims it as its own. President Biden has said the U.S. military does have some concerns about the proposed trip. An official of Pelosi's rank hasn't visited Taiwan in over 25 years since the Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich made the trip. Her planned visit comes at a time when tensions between the U.S. and China are high. You can join the show at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Should the U.S. play a strong role in supporting Taiwan? Do you worry about provocation from China in the region? What do you want to know about how Taiwan fits into U.S.-China relations? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Rosalind Shea is an associate professor of political science at Temple University, where she co-directs the Certificate in Political Economy. Her new book is called Microinstitutional Foundations of Capitalism, Sectoral Pathways to Globalization in China, India, and Russia. Rosalind, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the latest news this week, a big picture. Taiwan is in a very unique position. It is an independently functioning government. China claims it. A lot of the world has to sort of pretend it doesn't exist and yet interact with it. Can you talk about the status of Taiwan a little bit?
Yeah, so as you mentioned already, Taiwan is an independent governing country, and in many ways it is independent and sovereign. It has its own economy, it has its own military, and so one way to kind of periodize U.S.-China relations, U.S.-China-Taiwan relations, would be to look back a few decades into the end of the 1970s. That's in 1978 when the United States normalized diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China. And that was at the time during Jimmy Carter's administration when the Taiwan Relations Act was voted into law by the US Congress. And so essentially since the normalization of diplomatic relations and the Taiwan Relations Act, the United States in many ways have danced around this kind of policy of strategic ambiguity, in the sense that we, the United States, engages diplomatically and economically with China, which at that time was about to, open its open door policy and integrating into the global economy. But because of China's claim over the sovereignty of Taiwan, the United States officially has diplomatic relations with Taiwan, nor does it officially recognize Taiwan's independence, even though, as you mentioned, Taiwan is independently governed.
So why would China be particularly concerned about a U.S. Speaker of the House and other members of Congress paying an official visit to Taiwan?
So, in China's mind, having kind of one of the top executive officials, elected officials in the United States visit, as you mentioned earlier, the last time was in 1997 when Newt Gingrich visited Taiwan, to have a top official visit, in their mind, it is, essentially the United States officially diplomatically engaging Taiwan. And, with China's sovereign claim over Taiwan, this is something that China is unhappy about. But, in many ways we could characterize what Pelosi is doing and situating it in what the Fed President Janet Yellen spoke about or recently advocated, which is what she called friend shoring. And this is the idea that we focus on trading and investing with our allies and not our geopolitical rivals. And so Pelosi going to Taiwan, taking a trip to an allied country, is in a sense recognizing Taiwan as an important node of the global supply chain. So in some ways, it is not about intentionally provocating China, but rather, executing what the U.S. Economically, strategically is doing, which is focusing on trading and investing with our allies during a time of war.
Rosalind Shea is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University, looking at U.S.-China relations and Taiwan as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and possibly other members of Congress looking at a possible visit to Taiwan next month. China not happy about the notion, the leadership there. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from U.S. foreign policy when it comes to China? What questions do you have about this fairly sensitive and complicated bit of U.S. foreign policy and how it affects our economy, too? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we'll pick up our talk about Taiwan and U.S.-China relations with Rosalind Shea, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University. Things are tense already. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi looking at a possible trip to Taiwan. China criticizing that notion, concerns about some sort of military escalation or at least provocation. You could join in with your thoughts on all that, your questions for our guest right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rosalind, I assume, or I understand, internally in China now, there's a big deal coming up, a big party meeting where President Xi Jinping is looking at trying to have an unprecedented third term as president of that country. How important is that timing when it comes to China's reaction to this planned trip to Taiwan?
And certainly with the party congress coming up, Xi Jinping will have to appear to the domestic audience that he is taking a strong stance in regards to any quote-unquote provocations in regards to Taiwan. And, you know, with the geopolitical tensions right now, in many ways, Xi Jinping is forced to do, rhetorically anyway, to respond to what China is now characterizing as provocations. Now, in terms of what really, in fact, may in fact happen, I do not believe, and developments do not reveal that in fact China will, you know, will act militarily just because Nancy Pelosi takes this trip to Taiwan.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Franklin. Mike, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if we could have a little conversation. If we are going to take diplomatic approaches towards situations, and as situations get more and more tenuous, what is the status of our ability to have really good diplomacy on a world scale?
Mike, thanks for the call. Rosalind, can you talk about the state of U.S. diplomacy, our relationships with China? I know President Biden, I believe, expected to talk to the Chinese president as soon as tomorrow.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, we do have, open dialogue with China. In fact, as, you know, planned, Biden will have a conversation with Xi Jinping tomorrow. And in terms of relations with our allies around the world, the Asia Pacific, in particular, in May, when Biden visited Asia, he rolled out the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is essentially focused on diplomatic relations with countries in Asia, with the objective of diversifying supply chains and markets for the U.S. And in part, it is, in light of the geopolitical situation with the war going on in Russia and Ukraine, but it's also in response to Biden administration's response to what the China's increasingly closed economy focused on promoting indigenous industry that it can control. And so, as I have written about in my previous book, China's Regulatory State, and then also in my new book, Microinstitutional Foundations of Capitalism, what we have seen is that since that open door policy in 1978 that I mentioned earlier, China has really taken a liberalization two-step, which is, you know, it integrating into the global economy, part of being part of the WTO, courting foreign direct investment, but then all around the same time, in parallel, re-regulating. And so we had the Trump administration, for example, responding to that re-regulation, that kind of closing in of the Chinese markets and trade to foreign direct investment. The Trump administration responded to that with the U.S.-China trade war. Biden, on the other hand, is now focusing on what he's calling Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is diversifying supply chains and having more of a emphasis on trade relationship with Asia-Pacific. And along the same lines, as I mentioned earlier, the Fed president, Janet Yellen, is now advocating friendshoring. And so it's all along that same lines of let's focus on relationship, economic and political, diplomatic, with our allies in the Asia Pacific, as well as our allies around the world. And by doing so, then we could face our geopolitical rivals.
Mike, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Chris joins us now in La Crosse. Chris, hello.
Yeah, hello. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Chris?
Well, in 2012, I was out at Fort Lee, Virginia at the Logistics University for the military, and we had military guests from Taiwan there. And I was just curious, is how has the relationship changed from then to now if they're not recognized as their own entity, and or am I incorrect in understanding that, or what's going on there?
Chris, thanks for the call. Rosalind, as I understand it, the U.S. does supply military supplies to Taiwan. The kind of cooperative training exercises Chris mentioned, I think, might still go on, even though, again, we don't necessarily say Taiwan is a country.
Right. You're certainly right. In the context of strategic ambiguity, we also have in parallel the Taiwan Relations Act, which was voted into law in the U.S. Congress in 1978. And essentially, the Taiwan Relations Act commits the United States to selling weapons to Taiwan to maintain its self-defense capabilities. And it also empowers the United States to, you know, appropriately decide, U.S. Congress and the president together, to appropriately decide if for any reason that self-defense capacity changes in order to maintain peace and security in the Western Pacific area. And so indeed, the Taiwan Relations Act maintains military exercises, the selling of weapons to Taiwan for self-defense capabilities. And if, you know, that kind of defense, self-defense orientation changes, then the president and the United States Congress together can appropriately decide on solutions, and which could include military if it means that we need to do that to maintain peace and security. And all of this is empowered by the Taiwan Relations Act.
Chris, thanks for calling in. We're talking to Rosalind Shea from Temple University, looking at U.S.-China relations, Taiwan, a possible visit by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other members of Congress there next month, and objections from Chinese leadership to that possible visit. Rosalind, you mentioned military action from China you don't see as being very likely. One scenario that has people concerned is that China might step up its claims to waterways that most of the world looks at international waters. China says, nope, Chinese waters, and trying to assert that in some way, you know, not a full on military escalation, but something that would be worrisome, economically disruptive at the very least. Do you see that as a possible response from China?
You know, it's always possible. And in many ways, for those of us who've been watching developments around the world, China has already began to do such steps in other parts of the world, including in and around the Arctic Circle. And so if China does indeed do that, that wouldn't be something that's necessarily new. If China does do that, you know, that it would be considered by the United States as a provocation began by China. And again, relying on the Taiwan Relations Act, that would disrupt the self-defense capability of Taiwan.
We had a comment from Chris in Reedsburg who is asking for a little overview of why China and Taiwan are in this situation in the first place, where they're separate countries, but China claims Taiwan. Can you sum up some of the early history that led to this current situation?
Yeah, so we could begin with the end of World War II. The current, the Republic of China government that's on Taiwan, which actually had ruled Taiwan under martial law for 40 years and underwent democratic transition in the 1990s, that Republic of China government was headed by Chiang Kai-shek, and Chiang Kai-shek was in a civil war with Mao Zedong in the People's Republic of China, what, called mainland China, until the end of the Chinese Civil War and the end of World War II. And at that time, the United States, Chiang Kai-shek being an ally of the United States, and at the end of World War II, the United States essentially permitted the control of Taiwan to Chiang Kai-shek. And so since Chiang Kai-shek went to Taiwan in 1949, Taiwan and China have been governed separately. And in fact, really, Taiwan has been governed separately since the end of the 19th century in 1895 when, Japan came under, when Taiwan came under Japanese colonial control at the end of the Russo-Japanese War. But, let's not go all the way back. Let's just focus on World War II.
Rosalind, are you still
half
there?
Half century and beyond. Yes, I'm here. Essentially, in the last half century and beyond, Taiwan and China have been governed separately, and China has been laying claims over Taiwan.
In just our last minute or so, Rosalind, what are you watching for next as this story moves ahead over the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, I'm watching to see whether Nancy Pelosi will indeed take this trip, whether the Biden administration and Nancy Pelosi, Janet Yellen, and other administrators would be able to characterize and frame this trip as really about promoting global liberalism, about promoting, investing and trading with our allies, and really, painting a picture and framing this about the United States being for free trade and democracy.
Rosalind, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Rosalind Shea is an associate professor of political science at Temple University. She talked to us about House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's potential trip to Taiwan and how it's highlighted current tensions in the U.S. relationship with China.